pardon? Nothing, Miss Parker. Shall we switch it on to wartime favourites? Will that make you happy? We're going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried line. There was another burst of laughter. I'll put it in Mr. Sterling's office. Perhaps you can ask him what he prefers. She heard the mutters of dislike as she crossed the office, and made herself deaf to them. As the company had grown, the standards of the staff had sunk commensurately. Nowadays, nobody respected their superiors, the work ethic, or what Mr. Sterling had achieved. Quite frequently, she found herself in such a poor humour on her way home that she was at Elephanton Castle before even her crochet could distract her. Sometimes, it felt as if only she and Mr. Sterling, and perhaps Mrs. Kingston from accounts, understood how to behave. And the clothes, dolly birds they called themselves, and it was horribly apt, primping and preening, vacuous and childish. The girls in the typing pool spent far more time thinking about how they looked, all short skirts and ridiculous eye makeup, than the letters they were supposed to type. She had had to send back three yesterday afternoon. Misspellings, forgotten datelines, even a yours sincerely, where she had clearly stated yours faithfully. When she pointed it out, Sandra had raised her eyes to the ceiling, not caring that Moira saw her. Moira sighed, tucked the transistor under her arm, and, noting briefly that Mr. Sterling's office door was rarely shut at lunchtime, pushed on the handle and walked in. Marie Driscoll was sitting opposite him, and not on the chair that Moira used when she was taking dictation, but on his desk. It was such an astonishing sight that it took her a moment to register that he had stepped back suddenly as she entered. Ah, Moira. I'm sorry, Mr. Sterling, I didn't know anybody else was in here. She shot the girl a pointed look. What on earth did she think she was doing? Had everyone gone mad? I brought in this wireless. The girls had it on ridiculously loudly. I thought if they had to explain themselves to you, it might give them pause for thought.
I see.
He sat down in his chair. I was concerned they might be disturbing you. There was a long silence. Marie made no effort to move, just picked at something on her skirt, which ended halfway up her thigh. Moira waited for her to leave. But Mr. Sterling spoke.
I'm glad you came in. I wanted a private word. Miss Driscoll, could you give us a minute?
With evident reluctance, the girl lowered her feet to the floor and stalked past Moira, eyeing her as she passed. She wore too much perfume, Moira thought. The door closed behind her, and then it was just the two of them, as she liked it. Mr. Sterling had made love to her twice more in the months after that first time. Perhaps made love was a slight exaggeration. On both occasions he had been very drunk. It was briefer and more functional than it had been the first time, and the following day he had made no reference to it. Despite her attempts to let him know he would not be rebuffed, the homemade sandwiches she had left on his desk, the especially nice way she had kept her hair, it had not happened again. Still, she had known she was special to him, had relished her private knowledge when her co-workers discussed the boss in the canteen. She understood the strain such duplicity would cause him, and even while she wished things were different, she respected his admirable restraint. On the rare occasions when Jennifer Sterling dropped in, she no longer felt cowed by the woman's glamour. If you had been wife enough, he would never have needed to turn to me. Mrs. Sterling had never been able to see what she had in front of her. Sit down, Moira. She perched in a far more decorous manner than the Driscoll girl, arranging her legs carefully, suddenly regretting that she had not worn her red dress. He liked her in it, had said so several times. From outside the office, she heard laughter, and wondered absently if they'd got hold of another transistor somehow. I'll tell those girls to pull themselves together, she murmured. I'm sure they must make an awful racket for you. He didn't seem to hear her. He was shuffling papers on his desk. When he looked up, he didn't quite meet her eye.
I'm moving Marie with immediate effect. Oh, I think that's very good, to be my personal assistant.
There was a brief silence. Moira tried not to show how much she minded. The workload had got heavier, she told herself. It was understandable that he would think a second pair of hands was needed. But where will she sit? She asked. There's only room for one desk in the outer office.
I'm aware of that.
I suppose you could move Maisie.
That won't be necessary. I've decided to lighten your workload a little. You'll be moving to the typing pool.
She couldn't have heard him correctly.
The typing pool? I've told payroll you'll remain on the same salary, so it should be rather a good move for you, Moira. Perhaps give you a bit more of a life outside the office. A little more time to yourself.
But I don't want time to myself.
Let's not make a fuss now. As I said, you'll be on the same salary, and you'll be the most senior of the girls in the pool. I'll make that quite clear to the others. As you said, they need someone capable to take charge of them.
But I don't understand.
She stood up, her knuckles white on the transistor. Panic rose in her chest.
What have I done wrong? Why would you take my job away from me?
He looked irritated.
You've done nothing wrong. Every organisation moves people around once in a while. Times are changing, and I want to freshen things up a bit.
Freshen things up?
Marie is perfectly capable.
Marie Driscoll's going to be doing my job. But she knows nothing of how the office runs. She doesn't know the Rhodesian wage system, the telephone numbers, or how to book your air tickets. She doesn't know the filing system. She spends half her time in the ladies' room doing her makeup, and she's late all the time. Why, twice this week I've had to reprimand her. Have you seen the figures on the clocking in cards?
The words tumbled out of her.
I'm sure she can learn. It's just a secretarial job, Moira.
But
I really don't have any more time to discuss this. Please move your things out of the drawers this afternoon, and we'll start afresh with the new set-up tomorrow.
He reached into his cigar box, signalling that the conversation was over. Moira stood up, putting out a hand to steady herself on the edge of his desk. Bile rose in her throat. Blood thumped in her ears. The office felt as if it was collapsing on her, brick by brick. He put the cigar into his mouth, and she heard the sharp snip of the clippers as they sheared off the end. She walked slowly towards the door and opened it, hearing the sudden hush in the outer office that told her others had known this was taking place before she had been told. She saw Marie Driscoll's legs stretched against her desk, long, spindly legs in ridiculous coloured tights. Who on earth would wear royal blue tights to an office and expect to be taken seriously? She snatched her handbag from her desk and made her way unsteadily through the office to the ladies, feeling the stares of the curious and the smirks of the less than sympathetic burning into the back of her blue cardigan.
Moira, they're playing your song. Can't get used to losing you.
Oh, don't be mean, Sandra. There was another noisy burst of laughter, and then the cloakroom door was closing behind her. Jennifer stood in the middle of the bleak little play park, watching the frozen nannies chatting over their silver cross prams, hearing the cries of small children who collided and tumbled like skittles to the ground. Mrs. Cordoza had offered to bring Esme, but Jennifer had told her she needed the air. For 48 hours she had not known what to do with herself, her body still sensitized by his touch, her mind reeling with what she had done. She was almost felled by the enormity of what she had lost. She couldn't anesthetize her way through this with Valium. It had to be endured. Her daughter would be a reminder that she had done the right thing. There had been so much she had wanted to say to him. Even as she told herself she had not set out to seduce him, she knew she was lying. She had wanted one small piece of him, one beautiful, precious memory to carry with her. How could she have known she would be opening Pandora's box? Worse, how could she have imagined he would be so destroyed by it? That night at the embassy,
He had looked so pulled together. He couldn't have suffered as she had. He couldn't have felt what she had. He was stronger, she had believed. But now she couldn't stop thinking about him, his vulnerability, his joyful plans for them, and the way he had looked at her when she had walked across the hotel lobby towards her child. She heard his voice, anguished and confused, echoing down the corridor behind her.
"Don't do this, Jennifer! I'm not going to wait another 4 years for you!"
"Forgive me," she told him silently, 1,000 times a day. "But Lawrence would never have let me take her. And you, of all people, couldn't ask me to leave her. You, more than anyone, should understand." Periodically, she wiped the corners of her eyes, blaming the high wind or yet another piece of grit that had mysteriously found its way into one. She felt emotionally raw, acutely aware of the least change in temperature, buffeted by her shifting emotions. "Lawrence is not a bad man," she told herself repeatedly. "He's a good father, in his way. If he found it hard to be nice to Jennifer, who could blame him? How many men would forgive a wife for falling in love with someone else?" Sometimes she had wondered whether, if she hadn't got pregnant so quickly, he would have tired of her, chosen to cut her loose. But she didn't believe it. Lawrence might not love her any more, but he wouldn't contemplate the prospect of her existing somewhere else without him.
"And she is my consolation."
She pushed her daughter on the swing, watching her legs fly up, the bouncing curls flying in the breeze. "This is so much more than many women have. As Anthony had once told her, there was comfort to be had in knowing you had done the right thing."
"Mama!"
Dorothy Moncrief had lost her hat, and Jennifer was briefly distracted by the search. The two little girls walking with her around the swings, the spinning roundabout, peering under the benches until it was located on the head of some other child.
"It's wrong to steal,"
said Dorothy solemnly, as they walked back across the play park. "Yes," said Jennifer, "but I don't think the little boy was stealing. He probably didn't know the hat was yours."
"If you don't know what's right and wrong, you're probably stupid,"
Dorothy announced.
"Stupid,"
echoed Esme delightedly.
"Well, that's possible," Jennifer said.
She retied her daughter's scarf and sent them off again, this time to the sand pit, with instructions that they were absolutely not to throw sand at each other. "Dearest Boot," she wrote, in another of the 1,000 imaginary letters she had composed over the past 2 days, "please don't be angry with me. You must know that if there was any way on earth I could go with you, I would do so." She would send no letter. What was there to say other than what she had already said? "He'll forgive me in time," she told herself. "He'll have a good life." She tried to shut her mind to the obvious question. How would she live? How could she carry on knowing what she now knew? Her eyes had reddened again. She pulled a handkerchief out of her pocket and dabbed them again, turning away so that she wouldn't attract attention. Perhaps she would pay a quick visit to her doctor after all. Just a little, to help her get through the next couple of days. Her attention was drawn to the tweed-coated figure walking across the grass towards the play park. The woman's feet tramped determinedly forward with a kind of mechanical regularity, despite the muddiness of the grass. She realized with surprise that it was her husband's secretary. Moira Parker walked right up to her and stood so close that Jennifer had to take a step backwards.
"Miss Parker?"
Her lips were tightly compressed, her eyes bright with purpose. "Your housekeeper told me where you were. May I have a quick word?"
Yes, of course."
She turned briefly.
"Darling, Dotty, Esme, I'll just be over here."
The children looked up, then resumed digging. They walked a few paces, Jennifer positioning herself so that she could see the little girls. She had promised the Moncrief nanny she would have Dorothy home by 4, and it was nearly 1:45. She pasted on a smile.
"What is it, Miss Parker?"
Moira reached into a battered handbag and wrenched out a fat folder.
"This is for you,"
she said brusquely. Jennifer took it from her,
She opened it and immediately placed her hand on top of the papers as the wind threatened to whip them away.
Don't lose any of them.
It was an instruction. I'm sorry, I don't understand. What are these?
They are the people he has paid off.
When Jennifer looked blank, Moira continued.
Mesothelioma, lung disease. They are workers he paid off because he wanted to hide the fact that working for him has given them terminal illnesses.
Jennifer lifted a hand to her head. What?
Your husband. The ones who have already died are at the bottom. Their families had to sign legal waivers that stopped them saying anything in order to get the money.
Jennifer struggled to keep up with what the woman was saying. Died? Waivers?
He got them to say he wasn't responsible. He paid them all off. The South Africans got hardly anything. The factory workers here were more expensive.
But asbestos doesn't hurt anyone. It's just troublemakers in New York who are trying to blame him. Lawrence told me. Moira didn't seem to be listening. She ran her hand down a list on the top sheet.
They're all in alphabetical order. You can speak to the families if you want. Most of their addresses are at the top. He's terrified that the newspapers will get hold of it all.
It's just the unions, he told me.
Other companies are having the same problem. I listened in on a couple of telephone conversations he had with Good Asbest in America. They're funding research that makes asbestos look harmless.
The woman was speaking so fast that Jennifer's head reeled. She glanced at the two children, now throwing handfuls of sand at each other.
Moira Parker said pointedly, "You do realize it would ruin him if anyone found out what he'd done. It'll come out eventually, you know. It'll have to. Everything does."
Jennifer held the folder gingerly, as if it, too, might be contaminated.
"Why are you giving this to me? Why on earth do you think I'd want to do anything that might harm my husband?"
Moira Parker's expression changed and became almost guilty. Her lips had pursed into a thin red line.
"Because of this."
She pulled out a creased piece of paper and thrust it into Jennifer's hand.
"It came a few weeks after your accident, all those years ago. He doesn't know I kept it."
Jennifer unfolded it, the wind whipping it against her fingers. She knew the handwriting.
"I swore I wouldn't contact you again. But 6 weeks on, I feel no better. Being without you, thousands of miles from you, offers no relief at all. The fact that I'm no longer tormented by your proximity, or presented with daily evidence of my inability to have the one thing I truly want, has not healed me. It has made things worse. My future feels like a bleak, empty road. I don't know what I'm trying to say, darling Jenny. Just that if you have any sense at all that you made the wrong decision, this door is still wide open. And if you feel that your decision was the right one, know this at least. That somewhere in this world is a man who loves you. Who understands how precious and clever and kind you are. A man who has always loved you. And to his detriment, suspects he always will. Your B."
Jennifer stared at the letter as the blood strained from her face. She glanced at the date. Almost 4 years ago, just after the accident. "Did you say Lawrence had this?"
Moira Parker looked at the ground. "He made me shut down the post office box."
"He knew Anthony was still alive?" She was shaking.
"I don't know about any of that."
Moira Parker hoisted up her collar. She managed to look disapproving. A cold stone had settled inside Jennifer. She felt the rest of herself harden around it. Moira Parker clipped her handbag shut.
"Anyway, do what you want with it all. He can go hang for all I care."
She was still muttering to herself as she began to walk back across the park. Jennifer sank onto a bench, ignoring the two children, who were now joyfully rubbing sand into each other's hair. She read the letter again.
She took Dorothy Moncrief home to her nanny, and asked Mrs. Cordoza if she would walk Esme to the sweet shop. Buy her a lollipop, and perhaps a quarter of a pound of boiled sweets. She stood at the window to watch them go down the road, her daughter's every step a little bounce of anticipation. As they turned the corner, she opened the door to Lawrence's study, a room she rarely entered, and from which Esme was banned, lest her inquisitive little fingers presume to displace one of its many valuable items. Afterwards, she was not sure why she had even gone in there. She had always hated it, the gloomy mahogany shelves, full of books he had never read, the lingering smell of cigar smoke, the trophies and certificates for achievements she could not recognize as such. Round Table Businessman of the Year, Best Shot Cowbridge Deerstalk, 1959, Golfing Trophy, 1962. He rarely used it. It was an affectation, a place he promised his male guests where they might escape the women, a refuge in which he professed to find peace. Two comfortable armchairs stood on each side of the fireplace, their seats barely dented. In 8 years, a fire had never been lit in the grate. On the sideboard, the cut-glass tumblers had never been filled with fine whiskey from the decanter that stood beside them. The walls were lined with photographs of Lawrence, shaking hands with fellow businessmen, visiting dignitaries, the South African Trade Minister, the Duke of Edinburgh. It was a place for other people to see. Yet another reason for the men to admire him. Lawrence Sterling, lucky bugger. Jennifer stood in the doorway beside the caddy of expensive golf clubs, the shooting stick in the corner. A knot, tight and hard, had formed in her chest, just at the point of her windpipe, where air was meant to expand her lungs. She realized she could not breathe. She picked up a golf club and walked into the center of the room. A small sound escaped her, like the gasp of someone ending a long race. She lifted the club above her head as if to imitate a perfect swing, and let it go, so that the full force met the decanter. Glass splintered across the room, and then she swung again at the walls, the photographs shattering in their frames, the dented trophies knocked from their stands. She swung at the leather-bound books, the heavy glass ashtrays. She hit fiercely, methodically, her slim frame fueled by an anger that even now continued to build in her. She beat the books from their cases, sent the frames flying from the mantelpiece. She brought the club down like an axe, splintering the heavy Georgian desk, then sent it whistling sideways. She swung until her arms ached and her whole body was beaded with sweat, her breath coming in short, sharp bursts. Finally, when there was nothing left to break, she stood in the center of the room, her shoes crunching on broken glass, wiping a sweaty frond of hair off her forehead as she surveyed what she had done. Lovely Mrs. Sterling, sweet-tempered Mrs. Sterling, even, calm, tamped down, her fire extinguished. Jennifer Sterling dropped the bent club at her feet. Then she wiped her hands on her skirt, picked out a small shard of glass, which she dropped neatly to the floor, and left the room, closing the door behind her. Mrs. Cordoza was sitting in the kitchen with Esme when Jennifer announced that they were going out again. "Does the child not want her tea? She'll be hungry."
"I don't want to go out,"
Esme chimed in. "We won't be long, darling," she said coolly. "Mrs. Cordoza, you can take the rest of the day off."
"But I..."
"Really? It's for the best." She scooped up her daughter, the suitcase she had just packed, the sweets in the brown paper bag, ignoring the housekeeper's perplexity. Then she was outside, down the steps, and hailing a taxi. She saw him, even as she opened the double doors, standing outside his office, talking to a young woman at his desk. She heard a greeting, heard her own measured response, and was dimly surprised that she could be responsible for such a normal exchange. "Hasn't she grown?" Jennifer looked down at her daughter, who was stroking her string of pearls. then at the woman who had spoken. "Sandra, isn't it?" she said.
"Yes, Mrs. Sterling."
"Would you mind terribly letting Esme have a little play on your typewriter while I nip in to see my husband?" Esme was delighted to be let loose on the keyboard, cooed and fussed over by the women who immediately surrounded her, delighted by a legitimate diversion from work. Then Jennifer pushed her hair off her face and went to his office. She walked into the secretary's area where he was standing. "Jennifer?" He raised an eyebrow. "I wasn't expecting you."
"A word?" she said.
"I have to go out at 5.
"It won't take long."
He shepherded her into his own office, closing the door behind him, and motioned her towards the chair. He seemed mildly irritated when she declined to sit, and sank heavily into his own leather chair.
"Well?"
"What did I do to make you hate me so much?"
"What?"
"I know about the letter."
"What letter?"
"The one you intercepted at the post office 4 years ago."
"Oh, that,"
he said dismissively. He wore the expression of someone who had been reminded that he had forgotten to pick up some item from the grocer.
"You knew, and you let me think he was dead. You let me think I was responsible."
"I thought he probably was, and this is all history. I can't see the point of dragging it up again."
He leant forward and pulled a cigar from the silver box on his desk. She thought briefly of the dented one in his study, shimmering with broken glass.
"The point is, Lawrence, that you've punished me day after day. Let me punish myself. What did I ever do to you to deserve that?"
He threw a match into the ashtray.
"You know very well what you did."
"You let me think I killed him."
"What you thought has nothing to do with me. Anyway, as I said, it's history. I really don't see why..."
"It's not history. Because he's back."
That got his attention. She had a faint inkling that the secretary might be listening outside the door, so she kept her voice low.
"That's right. And I'm leaving to be with him. Esme too, of course."
"Don't be ridiculous."
"I mean it."
"Jennifer, no court in the land would let a child stay with an adulterous mother. A mother who can't get through the day without a pharmacy of pills. Mr. Hargreaves would testify to the sheer number you get through."
"They're gone. I've thrown them away."
"Really?"
He consulted his watch again.
"Congratulations. So you've made it a whole 24 hours without pharmaceutical help. I'm sure the courts would find that admirable."
He laughed, pleased with his response.
"Do you think they would find the lung disease file admirable, too?"
She caught the sudden rigidity of his jaw, the flash of uncertainty.
"What?"
"Your old secretary gave it to me. I have the name of every one of your employees who has become ill and died over the past 10 years.
"What was it?" She pronounced the word carefully, emphasizing its unfamiliarity. "Mesothelioma." The colour drained so quickly from his face that she thought he might pass out. He got up and walked past her to the door. He opened it, peered out, then closed it again firmly.
"What are you talking about?"
"I have all the information, Lawrence. I even have the bank slips for the money you paid them."
He wrenched open a drawer and rifled through it. When he straightened up, he looked shaken. He took a step towards her so that she was forced to meet his gaze.
"If you ruin me, Jennifer, you ruin yourself."
"Do you really think I care?"
"I'll never divorce you."
"Fine,"
she said, her resolve strengthened by his disquiet.
"This is how it will be. Esme and I will take a place nearby, and you can visit her. You and I will be husband and wife in name only. You will give me a reasonable stipend to support her. And in return, I'll make sure those papers are never made public."
"Are you trying to blackmail me?"
"Oh, I'm far too dim to do something like that, Lawrence, as you've reminded me countless times over the years. No, I'm just telling you how my life is going to be. You can keep your mistress, the house, your fortune, and your reputation.
none of your business colleagues needs to know. But I will never set foot in the same house as you again.
He genuinely hadn't realized she knew about the mistress. She saw impotent fury spread over his face, mixed with wild anxiety. Then they were smothered by a conciliatory attempt at a smile.
Jennifer, you're upset. This fellow reappearing must have come as a shock. Why don't you go home and we'll talk about it?
I've lodged the papers with someone. If anything were to happen to me, he has his instructions.
He had never looked at her with such venom. Her grip tightened on her handbag.
You are a whore,
he said. With you, I was, she said quietly. I must have been, because I certainly didn't do it for love.
There was a knock at the door, and his new secretary walked in. The manner in which the girl's gaze flicked between them was a banner of extra information. It boosted Jennifer's courage.
Anyway, I think that's all I needed to tell you. I'll be off now, darling, she said.
She walked up to him and kissed his cheek.
I'll be in touch. Goodbye, Miss...
She waited.
Driscoll,
the girl said.
Driscoll.
She fixed her with a smile.
Of course.
She walked past the girl, collected her daughter, and, heart hammering, opened the double doors, half expecting to hear his voice, his footsteps behind her. She skipped down the two flights of stairs to where the taxi was still waiting.
Where are we going?
Said Esme, as Jennifer hoisted her onto the seat beside her. She was picking her way through a handful of sweets, her haul from the troop of secretaries. Jennifer leant forward and opened the little window, shouting to the driver above the noise of the rush hour traffic. She felt suddenly weightless, triumphant.
To the Regent Hotel, please, as fast as you can.
Later, she would look back on that 20-minute journey and realize she had viewed the crowded streets, the gaudy shop fronts, as if through the eyes of a tourist, a foreign correspondent, someone who had never seen them before. She noted only a few details, an overriding impression, knowing it was possible she might not see them again. Her life as she had known it was over, and she wanted to sing. This was how Jennifer Sterling said goodbye to her old life, the days when she had walked those streets laden with shopping bags, filled with things that meant nothing to her as soon as she returned home. It was at this point, near Marylebone Road, that she felt daily the stiffening of some internal brace as she approached the house that no longer felt like a home, but some kind of penance. There was the square, flashing by, with her silent house, a world in which she had lived internally, knowing there was no thought she could express, no action she could complete that would not invoke criticism from a man she had made so unhappy that his only course was to keep punishing her with silence, relentless slights, and an atmosphere that left her permanently cold even in high summer. A child could protect you from that, but only so far. And while what she was doing meant she might be disgraced in the eyes of those around her, she could show her daughter that there was another way to live, a way that did not involve anaesthetizing yourself, a way that did not mean you lived your whole life as an apology for being who you were. She saw the window where the prostitutes had displayed themselves. The tapping girls had disappeared to some other location. I hope you're living a better life, she told them silently. I hope you're freed from whatever held you there. Everyone deserves that chance. Esme was still eating her sweets, observing the busy streets through the other window. Jennifer put her arm around the little girl and pulled her close. She unwrapped another and put it into her mouth.
Mummy, where are we going?
To meet a friend. And then we're going on an adventure, darling, she replied, suddenly brimming with excitement. She had nothing, she thought. Nothing.
An adventure?
Yes, an adventure that should have taken place a long, long time ago. The four-page story on the disarmament negotiations wouldn't make a lead,
Don Franklin thought, while his deputy drew up alternatives. He was wishing his wife hadn't put raw onions in his liver sausage sandwiches. They always gave him guts ache.
If we move the toothpaste out to this side, we could fill this space with a dancing priest,
the deputy suggested.
I hate that story. What about the theatre review? Already on page 18. Eyes west, south west, boss.
Rubbing his belly, Franklin glanced up to see a woman hurrying through the newspaper office. She was dressed in a short black trench coat and had a blonde child with her. To see a little girl in a newspaper office made Don feel uncomfortable, like seeing a soldier in a petticoat. It was all wrong. The woman paused to ask Cheryl something, and Cheryl gestured to him. His pencil was wedged in the corner of his mouth as she approached. "I'm sorry to bother you, but I need to speak to Anthony O'Hare," she said.
"And you are?"
"Jennifer Sterling. I'm a friend of his. I've just come from his hotel, but they said he'd checked out." Her eyes were anxious. "You brought the note a couple of days ago," Cheryl recalled. "Yes," the woman said. "I did." He observed the way Cheryl was looking her up and down. The child was holding a half-eaten lollipop, which had left a sticky trail on the mother's sleeve.
"He's gone to Africa," he said.
"What?"
"Gone to Africa."
She went completely still. The child, too.
"No," her voice cracked. "That's not possible. He hadn't even decided whether to go."
Don took the pencil out of his mouth and shrugged.
"News moves fast. He left yesterday. Got the first flight out. He'll be travelling for the next few days."
"But I need to speak to him."
"He can't be contacted."
He could see Cheryl watching him. Two of the other secretaries were whispering to each other. The woman had paled.
"Surely there must be some way of reaching him. He can't have been gone long."
"He could be anywhere. It's Congo. They don't have telephones. He'll telegraph when he gets a chance."
"Congo? But why on earth did he go so soon?"
Her voice had faded to a whisper.
"Who knows?"
He looked at her pointedly.
"Perhaps he wanted to get away."
He was aware of Cheryl loitering, pretending to sort a pile of papers nearby. The woman seemed to have lost the power of thought. Her hand lifted to her face. He thought for one awful moment that she might be about to cry. If there was one thing worse than a child in a newsroom, it was a crying woman with a child in a newsroom. She took a deep breath, steadying herself.
"If you speak to him, would you ask him to telephone me?"
She reached into her bag, from which she pulled out a paper folder, stuffed with documents, then several battered envelopes. She hesitated and thrust them deep inside.
"And give him these. He'll know what it means."
She scribbled a note, ripped it from her diary, and pushed it under the flap. She placed the folder on the desk in front of him.
"Sure."
She took hold of his arm. She was wearing a ring with a diamond the size of a ruddy Kohinoor.
"You'll make sure he gets it. It's really important. Desperately important."
"I understand. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to get on. This is our busiest time of day. We're all on deadlines here."
Her face crumpled.
"I'm sorry. Please, just make sure he gets it. Please."
Don nodded. She waited, her eyes not leaving his face, perhaps trying to reassure herself that he had meant what he said. Then, with a final glance around the office as if to check that O'Hare really wasn't there, she took her daughter's hand. "I'm so sorry to have bothered you." Looking somehow smaller than she had when she walked in, she made her way slowly towards the doors, as if she had no idea where she was going. A few people gathered around the subs desk watched her leave.
"Congo," said Cheryl after a beat. "I need to get page 4 off stone."
Don stared fixedly at the desk.
"Let's go with the dancing priest."
It was almost 3 weeks later that someone thought to clear the sub-editor's desk. Among the old galley proofs and dark blue carbon sheets, there was a shabby folder.
"Who's B?"
Dora, the temporary secretary, opened it.
Is there something for Bentinck? Didn't he leave 2 months ago?
Cheryl, who was arguing about travel expenses on the phone, shrugged without turning, but cupped her hand over the mouthpiece.
If he can't see who it belongs to, send it to the library. That's where I put everything that doesn't seem to belong to anyone. Then Don can't yell at you.
She thought for a moment. Well, he can, but not for misfiling.
The folder landed on the trolley destined for the archive, with the old editions of the newspaper, Who's Who and Hansard, in the bowels of the building. It would not reappear for almost 40 years. Part 3.
You and Me Finished. Male to Female, by a text message.
Chapter 16.
2003. Tuesday. Red Lion. Any good? John. Kiss. She waits for 20 minutes before he arrives, all cold air and apologies. A radio interview had gone on longer than he'd expected. He bumped into a sound engineer he'd known at university who wanted to catch up. It would have been rude to rush away.
But not rude to leave me sitting in a pub, she replies silently.
But she doesn't want to upset the mood, so she smiles.
You look lovely, he says, touching the side of her face. Had your hair done?
No.
Ah, just habitually lovely, then.
And with one sentence, his lateness is forgotten. He's wearing a dark blue shirt and a khaki jacket. She had once teased him that it was a writer's uniform. Understated, muted, expensive. It's the outfit she imagines him in when she's not with him. How was Dublin?
Horrid, harried.
He unwinds his scarf from his neck.
I have this new publicist, Roz, and she seems to think it her duty to pack something into every last 15-minute slot. She'd actually allocated me loo breaks.
She laughs.
Are you drinking?
He motions to a waiter, having spotted her empty glass. White wine. She hadn't been planning to have more. She's trying to cut down. But now he's here and her stomach has those knots that only alcohol can loosen. He chats on about his trip, the books sold, the changes in the Dublin waterfront. She watches him as he talks. She'd read somewhere that you only truly saw what someone looked like in the first few minutes of meeting them. That after then it was only an impression, coloured by what you thought of them. It gave her comfort on the mornings when she woke up, puffy-faced after drinking too much, or with eyes pixelated from lack of sleep. You will always be beautiful to me, she told him in her mind.
Not working today, then?
She hauls herself back into the conversation. It's my day off. I worked last Sunday, remember? But I'm going to pop into the office anyway.
What are you working on?
Oh, nothing very exciting. I found an interesting letter, and wanted to have a root around in the archive in case there were more like it.
A letter?
Yes. He raises an eyebrow. Nothing to tell, really, she shrugs. It's old, from 1960. She doesn't know why she's being reticent, but she would feel strange showing him the raw emotion on the page. She's afraid he might think she had some hidden reason for showing it to him.
Ah, strictures were so much firmer then. I love writing about that period. It's so much more effective for creating tension.
Tension?
Between what we want and what we're allowed.
She looks at her hands. Yeah, I know all about that.
The pushing against boundaries, all those rigid codes of conduct.
Say that again? Her eyes meet his.
Don't. He murmurs, grinning. Not in a restaurant. Bad girl.
The power of words. She gets him every time. She feels the pressure of his leg against hers. After this, they will return to her flat, and she will have him to herself for at least an hour. It isn't enough, it never is, but the thought of it, his body against hers, is already making her giddy. Do you still want to eat? She asks slowly.
That depends.
Their eyes linger on each other, For her, there is nothing in the bar but him. He shifts in his chair.
Oh, before I forget, I'm going to be away from the 17th.
Another tour? His legs are enclosing hers under the table. She struggles to focus on what she's saying. Those publishers are keeping you busy.
No,
he says, his voice neutral.
Holiday.
The briefest pause. And there it was. An actual pain. Something like a punch, just under her ribs. Always the softest part of her. Nice for you. She pulls her legs back. Where are you going?
Barbados.
Barbados? She can't help the surprise in her voice. Barbados. Not camping in Brittany. Not some distant cousin's cottage in rain-soaked Devon.
Barbados doesn't suggest the drudgery of a family holiday. It suggests luxury, white sand, a wife in a bikini. Barbados suggests a treat, a destination that implies their marriage is still of value. It suggests they might have sex. I don't suppose there'll be internet access, and the phone will be difficult. Just so you know.
Radio silence.
Something like that.
She doesn't know what to say. She feels quietly furious with him, while conscious that she has no right to be. What has he ever promised her, after all?
Still, there's no such thing as a holiday with small children,
he says, taking a swig of his drink.
Just a change of venue.
Really?
You wouldn't believe the amount of stuff you have to cart around, bloody prams, high chairs, nappies.
I wouldn't know. They sit in silence until the wine arrives. He pours her a glass, hands it to her. The silence expands, becomes overwhelming, catastrophic.
I can't help the fact that I'm married, Ellie, he says eventually. I'm sorry if it hurts you, but I can't not go on holiday because...
It makes me jealous, she finished.
She hates the way it makes her sound. Hates herself for sitting there like some sulking teenager. But she's still absorbing the significance of Barbados. The knowledge that for 2 weeks she will be trying not to imagine him making love to his wife.
This is where I should walk away, she tells herself, picking up her glass. This is where any sensible person pulls together the remnants of their self-respect, announces that they deserve more, and walks off to find someone who can give them a whole self, not snatch lunch times and haunted empty evenings.
Do you still want me to come back to yours?
He is watching her carefully, his whole face an apology, etched with the understanding of what he's doing to her. This man, this minefield. Yes, she says. There is a hierarchy in newspaper offices, and librarians are somewhere near the bottom. Not quite as low as canteen staff or security guards, but nowhere near the columnists, editors and reporters who comprise the action section, the face of the publication. They are support staff, invisible, undervalued, there to do the bidding of those who are more important. But no one seems to have explained this to the man in the long-sleeved T-shirt.
We're not taking requests today.
He points up at a handwritten notice taped to what had been the counter.
Sorry, no access to archive until Monday. Most requests can be answered online. Please try there first, and extension 3223 in an emergency.
When she looks up again, he's gone. She might have been offended, but she's still thinking about John. The way he shook his head as he pulled his shirt back over his head an hour previously.
Wow, he had said, tucking the tail into his waistband. I've never had angry sex before.
Don't knock it, she had replied, made flippant by temporary release. She was lying on top of the duvet, staring out through the skylight at the grey October cloud. It's better than angry no sex.
I liked it.
He had leant over and kissed her.
I quite like the idea of you using me, a mere vehicle for your pleasure.
She had thrown a pillow at him. He had been wearing that look, his edges softened, still locked into her, some idea, some memory of what had just passed between them. Hers. Do you think it would be easier if the sex wasn't so good? She asked, pushing her hair out of her eyes.
Yes. And no.
Because you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the sex. She had pushed herself upright, suddenly awkward. Right, she had said briskly. She had kissed his cheek, and then, for good measure, his ear. I need to get to the office. Lock the door on your way out. She padded into the bathroom. Conscious of his surprise, she had closed the door behind her and turned on the cold tap so that it gushed noisily down the plug hole. She perched on the rim of the bath and listened to him walking through to the living room, perhaps to get his shoes, then the footfall outside the door.
Ellie? Ellie?
She didn't respond.
Ellie, I'm going now.
She waited.
I'll speak to you soon, gorgeous.
He rapped twice on the door, and then he was gone. She had sat there for almost 10 minutes after she'd heard the front door slam. The man reappears as she's about to leave. He's carrying 2 teetering boxes of files, and is about to push open a door with his rear and disappear again.
Still here?
You've spelt there wrong. She points at the notice. He glances at it.
Just can't get the staff these days, can you?
He turns towards the door. Don't go, please! She leans over the counter, brandishes the folder he'd given her. I need to look at some of your 1960s newspapers, and I wanted to ask you something. Can you remember where you found that stuff you gave me?
Roughly. Why?
There was something in it. A letter. I thought it might make a good feature if I could flesh it out a little. He shakes his head.
Can't do it now. Sorry, we're flat out with the move.
Please, please, please! I need to get something together by the end of the weekend. I know you're really busy, but I only need you to show me. I'll do the rest. He has untidy hair, and his long-sleeved T-shirt is tracked with dust. An unlikely librarian. He looks as if he should be surfing on books rather than stacking them. He blows out his cheeks, dumps the box on the end of the counter.
Okay. What kind of letter?
It's this. She pulls the envelope out of her pocket.
Not a lot to go on, he says, glancing at it. A P.O. box and an initial.
He's curt. She wishes she hadn't made that crack about the spelling. I know. I just thought if you had any more in there, I might be able to...
I haven't got time to...
Read it, she urges. Go on, just read it. She tails off as she remembers she doesn't know his name. She's worked there for 2 years and she doesn't know any of the librarian's names.
Rory.
I'm Ellie.
I know who you are.
She raises her eyebrows.
Down here, we like to be able to put a face to a byline. Believe it or not, we talk to each other too.
He looks at the letter.
I'm pretty busy, and personal correspondence isn't the kind of thing we hold on to. I don't even know how it ended up in there.
He pushes it back to her, looks her in the eye.
That's T-H-E-R-E.
2 minutes. She shuts it at him. Please, Rory. He takes the envelope from her, pulls out the letter and reads, lingering. He finishes and looks up at her. Tell me you aren't interested. He shrugs. You are. She grins. You are. He flips open the counter and motions her through with an expression of resignation.
I'll have the newspapers you want on the counter in 10 minutes. I've been putting all the loose stuff in bin bags for throwing away, but yes, come on through. You can plough through them and see if you can put anything else together, but don't tell my boss, and don't expect me to help.
She's there for 3 hours. She forgets the 1960 newspaper file, and instead sits in the corner of the dusty basement, barely noticing, as men pass her carrying boxes marked Election 67, Train Disasters, or June to July 1982. She works through the bin bags, peeling apart reams of dusty paper, sidetracked by advertisements for cold cures, tonics, and long-forgotten cigarette brands, her hands blackened with dust and old printing ink. She sits on an upturned crate, stacking the papers around her in chaotic piles, searching for something smaller than A3, something handwritten. She's so lost in it that she forgets to check her mobile phone for messages, She even forgets, briefly, the hour she had spent at home with John, that normally would have stamped itself on her imagination for several days afterwards. Above, what remains of the newsroom is rumbling on, digesting and spewing out the day's news, its news lists changing again and again within the hour. Whole stories written and discarded, according to the latest digital alterations of the newswires. In the dark corridors of the basement, it might as well have been happening on a different continent. At almost 5:30, Rory appears with two polystyrene cups of tea. He hands one to her, blowing on his own as he leans against an empty filing cabinet.
How'd you get on?
Nothing. Plenty of innovative health tonics or cricket match results from obscure Oxford colleges, but no devastating love letters.
It was always going to be a long shot.
I know. It was just one of those... She lifts her tea to her lips. I don't know. I read it and it stayed with me. I wanted to know what happened. How's the packing going? He sits on a crate a few feet from her. His hands are ingrained with dust and there's a smudge on his forehead.
Nearly there. I can't believe my boss wouldn't let the professionals handle this.
The chief librarian had been at the newspaper for as long as anyone could remember, and was legendary for being able to pinpoint the date and copy of any newspaper from the most vague description.
Why not?
Rory sighed.
He was worried they'd put something in the wrong place or lose a box. I keep telling him it's all going to end up digitally recorded anyway, but you know how he is about hard copies.
How many years' worth of newspapers?
I think it's 80 of filed newspapers and something like 60 of clippings and associated documents. And the scary thing is, he knows where every last one belonged.
She begins to move some of the papers back into a bin bag.
Perhaps I should tell him about this letter. He could probably tell me who wrote it.
Rory whistles.
Only if you don't mind giving it back. He can't bear to let go of a single thing. The others have been sneaking the real junk out after he's gone home, or we'd have to fill several more rooms with it. If he knew I'd given you that old file of papers, he'd probably sack me.
She grimaces.
Then I'll never know,
she says theatrically.
Know what?
What happened to my star-crossed lovers? Rory considers this.
She said no.
Oh, you old romantic.
She had too much to lose.
She cocks her head at him.
How do you know it was addressed to a she?
Women didn't have jobs then, did they?
It's dated 1960. It's hardly the bloody suffragettes.
Here, give it to me.
He holds out his hand for the letter.
Okay. So maybe she had a job, but I'm sure it said something about going on a train. I should think a woman would be much less likely to say she was headed off to a new job.
He reads it again, pointing at the lines.
He's asking her to follow him. A woman wouldn't have asked a man to follow her. Not then.
You have a very stereotypical view of men and women.
No, I just spend a lot of time here immersed in the past.
He gestures around him.
And it's a different country.
Perhaps it wasn't addressed to a woman at all, she teases. Perhaps it's to another man.
Unlikely. Homosexuality.